All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. There's a few out there still buying things to take back home to the kids and grandkids. Our next speaker this morning is Judge Robin Ramsey. Judge Ramsey is currently a licensed attorney and the presiding municipal judge for the city of Denton. I will tell you that Judge Ramsey is also the only judge that I know that has openly admitted...
Where are you going with this?
That when he wears his robe, it looks like he's wearing a muumuu.
Muumuu, that's right.
Prior to becoming a judge, Mr. Ramsey served as a student's attorney for the University of North Texas and as an adjunct professor for business law. After leaving the University of North Texas and prior to his current appointment, Judge Ramsey practiced law in Louisville and Denton. He is also serves as the alternate mental health magistrate in Denton County at the assignment of the Denton County Probate Court. Please welcome my friend, Robin Ramsey.
You're always worried when Gary gives you the introduction a little bit. Well, good morning. Of course, ethics is one of those topics that I guess people always get a little nervous. I'll be honest, you know, as an attorney even, I force myself to read those little pages in the inside part of the bar journal every month, you know, the ones that, because there used to be, particularly when I first started practicing, I was in family law all the time, I would very carefully breeze over those pages, like touching them with some kind of form of death. So I realize there's a natural aversion to ethics discussions. But I really think that in our context, as municipal judges, particularly in the last couple of years, I felt, let me tell you a little bit about where I work. My primary job is as judge for the city of Denton. Denton is a city just north of Dallas. It's at the very top of, it's where I-35W and I-35E meet. So it's not a very big city, about 130,000, 140,000 people that live there. We have two major universities there, and that has some impact because we do have about 40 to 50,000 students have two universities there. But as a result of that, I think that we're at the top of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, and the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, in my opinion, has become, over the last few years, kind of a vicious area to drive. Not just hard on drivers, but that the law enforcement agencies, particularly in my county, Denton County is one of the fastest growing. I think every county I've talked to claims to be the fastest growing county. But Denton County says, you know, so we have 9 new police agencies in the last 2 years that have come online. So everyone's out there writing citations and making arrests. And so it's just a very vicious place. And they've also added in the North Texas area a few things that are peculiar to cities. Arlington, Dallas, Richardson, Garland, Denton, Carrollton have all started seizing vehicles that don't have insurance, which right now I don't know if there's any statutory authority under the state law to do that, to be honest with you. But they claim it's in their inherent authority as a state, as a general or charter city. We also are big about red light cameras in North Texas. They did them before the state law was there. And so as a result, and why I think that makes a difference for our positions, I think as municipal judges, we're seen as being those who are out there for money, revenue generation. Particularly now that the economy's down, people feel the pinch, and how often do we catch that comment about, hey, you know, I know what this whole gig is about. You're all here just to make the money. It's just a money thing. There's no justice. Let's drop the pretense. Just, you know, you just want to make money off of me. And I think it really calls upon us more than any other level of judges. And a lot of times when I speak, I'm going to give this rah-rah, but I truly, truly do believe it. I'm in my 14th or 15th year as a municipal judge full-time. But I'm saying to you, no matter where you serve as a judge, whether you're full-time or whether you're part-time, I believe that more people in this state form their opinion about how valid our judicial system is by what you do than any other judge. How many people know you as the judge in the town where you are? You know, most district judges and county court judges, they're not really going to remember. Most of them don't know what they look like. They don't know their names. But how many times have you, in fact, I'll tell you, when I first moved into, I was judge for City of Denton for a number of years, but I lived in Coppell, which is just to the south of Denton County. And so we moved from Coppell up to Denton. So I took my daughter up there to the local Walmart, which you have to understand, in Denton, Walmart is the center of all social activity. It is as close as we come to a country club. And if you go up there between, say, 9 or 10 o'clock at night, there's a whole new clientele that comes in. So we went up there to buy the things like the paper towels and the soaps and so forth when we're moving in. And she had come from, now Coppell, by contrast, is a very nice new city, has some money and so forth. But we went up into the Walmart at about 10 or 11 o'clock, and we walked in and walked down the first aisle, and there's this kid standing there with his mom. He goes, "Mom, that's the judge at the court where I'm on the court order." "Hi." And I go, "Hey, how's it going?" "Yeah, fine." Turned down the aisle, went down the other direction. We ran into the guy at the meat market, and he goes, "Hey, Judge, haven't been in jail for a while. Good to see you." You know, and as we're walking out through the cash register area, one of the clerks goes, "Do you remember me?" And I was going, "No, not really." And she goes, "I was in county jail for all those hot checks." And I was going, "Where's your manager? Why, do you want to talk to him?" "No, I just can't believe you're saying it with a manager all around." And then as we're walking out past to get to our car, I can still remember the guy's name, Art Seary. He wrote me a Christmas card from Nashville, Tennessee, saying, "Wish you were here, have a beer together." He was arrested 250 times in the city of Denton on PI charges alone. But Denton Police Department was scooping him up and put him in the back of the police car, and he goes, "See you in the morning, Judge." So we get in the car with my daughter. My daughter's kind of just sitting there, and she's just kind of quiet. And I said, "What's wrong?" She goes, "I don't know. I don't know if I like this place." And I said, "Well, why?" She goes, and I don't know what this comment really means, but I'll just leave it where she goes, "I don't know. It's like going to the state fair." So, but the point of that whole story was that truthfully, people recognize you. They know you as the judge. And they see you as truth and justice, if you are truth and justice. And when they come into your court, how they're treated, they walk away from that, because most of us only have contact with the judicial system in two areas. Thankfully, most of us only have contact. One is through jury service, and the other one is through traffic offenses. And so how they think that your system, now if they come to your court and they walk away thinking it's all about the cha-ching, there's no other point to it, you're just there to make the money, then I think you have a whole different problem on your hands. And so we are the ambassadors of the judicial system. I know that our district and county court brethren don't kind of recognize that. And congratulations for those of you who hadn't heard. I'm sure that you had. I don't think I'm going to want to be doing any marriages. And I think there's some ethical issues that we need to address. But at the same time, congratulations. You're finally, from a parity issue, you now can conduct marriages. And the only reason why I think that's important is in some ways, I have always felt, and I've had those judges, particularly district and county court judges, that kind of go, "Oh, you're a municipal judge." Right? And it used to really bother me. I had someone, I practiced family law for 20 years, and at the firm where I left, the attorney, when I was leaving, said, "Have you ever thought about running for a real judge?" No. And he said, and I didn't mean it that way. And I thought, well, how else could you have meant that? You know? But truthfully, I know that perception is there. But where I'm, and this is the end of the rah-rah part, but to the public, more people in the public see you and how you than any of those district or county court judges. More of them will recognize you at the Walmart or whatever your social center of your society is, and they will see you as being judged. And so how we conduct ourselves, how we require that our employees, our clerks, handle themselves, and that image that people walk away, I do not want them leaving the City of Denton Municipal Court believing that it's all about the money. Now, having said that, I think it is more difficult recently, and I've certainly had issues. We've had code enforcement issues that suddenly the City of Denton has decided we're going to be one of those nice, new, pristine little cities, and it can't happen overnight, but they're counting on code enforcement to do that. Also, automated collections process, such as red light enforcement, in my opinion, lessen the image of justice part. Because, and, of course, we don't hear those red light cases, right? But the message sent out by that is, it's about the cha-ching, man. Even the DPS surcharge system. It isn't that you can't drive if you're a really bad driver. It's that if you pay enough money, you can still drive. And that's the message. So I think you and I have this duty in life, I guess, in our positions. No matter what level of, no matter how large your court is. In fact, I'd argue the smaller the court, the more that's really true. Even jurors who come into your courtroom to serve on your juries, they're impacted by how judicial and how courtly your court is. So having said all that, let's look at a few of the complaints process. It is true that we are all subject to review by the Judicial Conduct Commission. These are some of the most recent available numbers, which actually is 2007. Yes, I know it's 2009, but the numbers come out in September. And so the last full year that we have available, 2007, according to the Judicial Conduct Commission, there are 3,716 judges in the state of Texas. They had 1,043 complaints. If you look at the breakdown of judges that are there, municipal judges by far are the largest group. They show 1,416 in 2007. I heard numbers that were up by about 50 or 60 above that now. Justice of the Peace, 821. So those are your two largest blocks of judges. 254 county, constitutional county court judges. Yeah, they're 254 counties. 142 associate judges, which are a little bit different. But of course, 98 appellate, 437 district courts, 240 county court of law. So it's a fairly large number of people, but 3,716. Of that, 1,043 complaints. Most of those complaints being filed, I guess if you had to pick one particular category of complaints, and this is an interesting difference between this and the next slide, the largest number of complaints came against district court judges. Justice of the Peace received the second largest, 235, but 47% were against district court judges, 235 against JPs. Municipal had only 61 or only 6% of the total complaints. Disciplinary actions taken, and that's what I'm saying. Out of the total number filed, although district judges had more complaints filed than any other category, of those that they upheld and took disciplinary action, Judicial Conduct Commission took action against 28 Justice of the Peace in 2007, or 62% of the complaints were against Justice of the Peace. Why do you think that's the difference between district judges and more filed against district judges? Does anyone have any idea why you'd probably have more district judges complained against? Inmates. That's exactly right. And those are state, they're felony cases. The odds are greater. Also, I'll tell you this. Family law, I used to practice family law. I can tell you as far as judicial or disciplinary complaints against attorneys, family law and criminal always lead the bar because you have people who are, they took the child away. So the stakes that the district court judges are perceived as being much greater. But after they get through all the complaints and the parts of the complaint, when they look at it, as far as those that they upheld, Justice of the Peace had the highest category. Four municipal court judges are 9%, but it went from Justice of the Peace to county court. District court, they only found or took disciplinary action in four cases and only four against municipal. So although we have by far the largest group, we have, with the exception of the constitutional county court, we have the smallest number of complaints. That, I tell you, is a good score. It's pretty impressive. Doesn't mean that we don't make mistakes, because we do. But not only do we have the largest number of judges, but I can also submit to you we have the largest number of cases. If you took Dallas, Fort Worth, Arlington, Austin, Houston, San Antonio alone, and El Paso alone, the numbers are massive, massive numbers. Number of cases disposed by criminal complaint. Well, it just says there. It does, and this is where we get grouped together with district court judges. Inmate, criminal defendant, and traffic defendant. I really would have liked to know what the breakdown is. Of course, in my experience in the county jail where I work every night, a lot of times those who are felonies, they have lots of criminal traffic cases too. Have you all seen that where they walk through and they have some very serious criminal charges? And they have like 28 traffic offenses, so it's the same mentality, I guess. But where they're coming from, litigants, traffic defendants, criminal defendants, I always love that anonymous. I guess someone just drops a postcard in the mail to the Judicial Conduct Commission, but that's where they come from. Again, our courts, we handle by far, and same thing with JPs, Justice of the Peace, had to share it, and there are so many commonalities. In fact, I'm going to say this now that I can say it. Once we're past this marriage bill thing, we have a lot of things with the JPs that we share. We need to get past the differences that have been in the past. And now we need to start talking about our commonalities, because we do have one huge common issue, and that is that we all deal with pro se litigants. More so, district judges, you know, there's a nice part about being a district judge. You are well buffered, at least in my counties and the counties I've practiced, Dallas County, Denton County, Collin County, and Tarrant County. Getting to a district judge, even if you're an attorney, is difficult to do. Security concerns, of course, now, but beyond that, just the ability to talk to them. Same thing's true with county court judges. But with us, how many of you have been stopped, and I do every morning? I park my car in various places, but in Tuesday mornings, yesterday morning, we have our indigency hearing docket, people asking for more time to pay, and that docket's grown in the last year, and they all know what car I drive, and they all sit out, and they wait, and it's kind of like I'm driving the ice cream truck, you know? And so I pull up, and I can see them all massing at the wall, you know, and they're all going, hey, Judge, can I get some more time? Yeah, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it in court. We deal with pro ses, and we are dealing with the people. We are the trench judges. I guess I'm getting real comfortable with the fact that this is what I'm going to be. And so I really do believe that we are the trench judges. We are the people who meet with the public. We're the ones that they come and look for us. They know our car. They know, in fact, even the bondsman, this shows how twisted it is in my county. Again, I work the county jail every night as the county magistrate. Actually, Judge Poston also does that too sometimes. Which reminds me, we're not covered for tonight, so I better get back there. Anyway, the bondsmen wait to take phone calls from the defendants when my car leaves the parking lot. So, again, we're identifiable. Pro se litigants, all shapes and sizes. Extremist groups. We've had the Texas Republics, not the bike rally group, but we've had those, and in fact, I think you now see some variations on that. People who go, I call them internet surfers. They go on there and they pick a little bit. There are so many sites on the internet that have ways that you can complain against the municipal court or, you know, information about radar. Some of it's from the 60s, but they go online, they find those, and they find little bits and pieces, and they will file tremendously long briefs that accuse you in the court of all different kinds of things, but I'll call them the extremist groups, and that includes Texas Republican, UCCers. Y'all remember those? I haven't seen one in a while. Those that would file UCC, say that, you know, a citation was under the Uniform Commercial Code, that I did not receive this citation, I'm not a bearer in good cause, and they'd use all the terminology of the Uniform Commercial Code. Mr. I Know Somebody. I'm a judge up in Pilot Point. I have a bunch of small cities too, and I remember that when I was in Pilot Point, they have a lot of large racehorse farms up there. And about 2 years ago, guy came up. I called him in line. I noticed he was shuffling, like, why am I at the front? And finally, I called his name. He came up there and goes, "Well, I'm Tommy." I'll say his name, Tommy Mannion. And I said, "Okay, well, Mr. Mannion, do you want to plead guilty, not guilty, or no contest?" And he said, "I'm Tommy Mannion." "Uh-huh. Well, Mr. Mannion, did you want to plead not guilty, guilty, or no contest?" And he leans down, because we have a little table there, and he leans down and he goes, "I don't think you heard me. I'm Tommy Mannion." "No, I think we have established that you're Tommy Mannion. Hi, I'm Robin Ramsey. Good, nice to meet you." And I said, "Did you want to play?" And his point was, he said, "I own majority of the city." And I said, "Well, that's nice. You have a nice city. Did you want to plead not guilty, guilty, or no contest?" And it became almost comical over time. But people who believe that because they are who they are in your small city, or that they know the mayor, they know the chief of police, they know the police officers, and you're going, "Yeah, well, so do I," right? So those are another problem. Hard timers, the people, "I'm going to sue you." I think that is a category we probably share with the district judges and county court judges. They show up at every level of court. Those that feel like they're bigger and badder than you are in the courtroom. Of course, as an attorney, I usually feel like going, "Well, yeah, go ahead and sue us, because that's how we make money. Thank you." The help me's. I think this is something peculiar to our level. That we and the JPs, that you have people that show up and go, "Well, I can't afford an attorney. I don't know what this whole thing is about, and I've never done this before." And I usually go, "Well, that's a good thing, right? Not doing it before, but you know, you still have." And they'll want you to give them direction on the case. And the others, and I'll tell you the others that recently have popped up, kind of an extension of the help me's. People who are angry about the economic status of our society. They're upset, they don't have money, but they give you the whole thing of, look, either they take the angry approach of, you're just trying to make money, you know, that's all this is about, or I'm sorry, I'm so poor, I can't do any community service, I don't have any money, I won't have any money, I just lost my job. I hear that a lot too. So that's that human level that we deal with. What's our challenge? Well, our challenge, of course, is to provide balance and fairness and impartiality. And to not only present that image, because sometimes I think we worry about the presentation of that information more than anything else, but to actually be fair, impartial, and balanced. And that, of course, we're the administrator of the system where we work. Someone every year, I don't know who it is, but every year that I speak, I apparently use the term my court. That's wrong. I don't own the court. It's not my court. It's not my system of justice. I make that. So if I use that term in this presentation, I don't mean it. But we are responsible for the courts. And what our court clerks say is an extension of what we're saying. So we're in charge of that. We need to make sure that we know that. Outcomes of any shortcomings will upset customers or clients. Again, this wasn't my originally my presentation, but and customers sometimes for a municipal court makes me a little nervous. I don't like that term. But on the other hand, I think that our cities sometimes expect for us to treat. How many have go to city council, or not city council meetings, but city management team meetings, and particularly in the larger cities, and they're going, well, you know, we're into customer care. And I'm going, yeah, but most of my customers are not customers because they want to be customers. It's not like they signed up for service. Nor did they want to move here. They just customers by demand. So, you know, they may be upset. They may come after us. Frustration with ourselves. I know I always go home and worry about some of the comments that I might have said or made. Complaints to authorities. Sometimes they go to your city council. I have luck. I want to say this very sincerely. I am very proud to work for the city I work for, and I'm beginning to think it's a very good place to work because I know that judges that feel pressure from their counsels all the time. My counsel largely leaves me alone, and if they get a complaint, they redirect it back to me, and I appreciate that. I know it's not that way for everybody. I wish it were, that's why I'm glad I'm not in a big city, and I'm not in a really small city. I'm in a mid-sized city, and I think in that sense, I'm a little bit better protected and isolated. Just recently, if you've been following it, in the Dallas Morning News, City of Dallas Municipal Court. They are they're running a number of stories, the city council. And the one thing that really disturbed me recently, just Monday, the mayor spoke on behalf of the city council and said that if the problems didn't resolve themselves within 30 days, the council was going to intervene in the operation of the court. That, to me, folks, is a major constitutional shutdown. I'm just going, huh? He actually said that and was printed in the paper? But no one, you know, if you look at the press, doesn't get upset. No one's too worried. But I'm telling you, when it comes down to that, folks, we might as well go find a different job. At least that's when I'm looking for a different job. I'll go back to doing divorces. That's one of the reasons I was happy about the marriage bill, because finally I can make, you know, repentance for I've done over 2,300 divorces. Yeah. My father was a minister, and he asked me about a couple of years ago. He goes, so how many divorces did you do? I said, well, how many marriages did you do? I was blown away. He knew exactly what he said, like 682. I said, yeah, about, yeah. Anyway, newspaper headlines, even in the smaller cities, you worry about the newspaper. I really do. I mean, I gave you that rah-rah speech at first, but let me tell you the other part of it is, I've had, and one of the rationales why we were not allowed to do marriages for years was that we're not elected. The implication being there that we're not responsive to the people. Let me tell you, my friends, you make a mistake, say something stupid, and you're going to come out in the paper, and that council will reach out and touch you a lot faster than the voters of the county would. And so as far as being responsive, no, I think we're about as responsive as you get. Yes, I know we're not supposed to be removed within our same term and all that, but let's cut the lace and feathers here. It's true, that council can and probably will. I've told that story before where I set a $5,000 murder bomb one time. And it was a very painful experience for me because it went onto every one of the major stations in Dallas. And, you know, and does it, how many people think $5,000 is low for a murder bomb? A little tad low, yeah. There were reasons, I promise. And it's kind of a strange story. But the media can reach out and touch it faster than I think our elected officials. Complaints to State Commission on Judicial Conduct. I have never received one. Just like a practicing attorney, actually, I never received a state bar complaint. But I can tell you that if I ever do and I get that envelope in the mail, I'm probably going to hit the floor first. And everyone's going to go, see, I knew he had a heart attack coming. Authority. Primarily, our authority as judges comes from the Constitution, and so does the authority of the Judicial Conduct Commission. Article 5 of the Texas Constitution, State Commission on Judicial Conduct has the authority to investigate and discipline all judges. Kind of a strange thing. I've been in this position for a while, and one of the individuals before they were elected, I mean, they were elected as a JP, but before they took office, came to me and said, you know, I've been really thinking about the civil stuff, and what I would like to do is go ahead and take the files home at night, and I'm going to call the individuals and kind of work out what they want, and then just take care of it ahead of time and kind of mediate it by phone a day or two before the trial. And I said, well, what are the problems with that? I said, I appreciate your judicial efficiency, but that will get you in trouble. Well, why is that? Well, it's called ex parte communication. You can't communicate with one side without the other one being there and knowing of it, so you can't do it. And he said to me, he turned out to be a very good JP, but he said, no, that doesn't apply to me because I'm elected. It applies to you. Judicial Conduct Code, you know, Commission applies to you, but it doesn't apply to me because I'm elected. People of Denton County elected me, and only they can remove me. And I said, well, I tell you what, I get that whole election process thing, but I'm telling you, they can and they will remove your authority to act as a judge. So take it as you will. He seemed frustrated, but I think we moved through it. Judicial misconduct can result from violation of Supreme Court rules, incompetence in performance of duties, of course, a very broad term, willful violation of code of judicial conduct, willful, of course, meaning not necessarily intentional, but with intent of some level. Judicial misconduct is willful conduct or persistent conduct that is clearly inconsistent with the proper performance of his duties. I hate it when it spells out that way. Willful conduct or persistent conduct that is clearly inconsistent with the proper performance of his or her duties, or that casts public discredit upon the judiciary or administration of justice. For those of you who are sight learners and you have to write it in, there's your answers. Willful conduct, I don't think most of us have a problem with that. Let me tell you one that I think we as municipal judges have to pay particular attention to, because we as municipal judges have clerks that very often run our courts. This is true from the smallest court to the largest court, and it's systemic. In fact, in the smaller courts, we have judges. I'm a judge at Crum and Pilot Point and so forth, and I only show up there once, twice, or three times a month. Who is that court? Who do most people have contact with? Court clerk. She's there every day. Same thing. And that's true with both of them. So the problem there is that if a court clerk decides that some process is going to take place and they don't discuss it with us, or that we go, oh, I don't want to see, I don't want to know, don't tell me about it, that clerk is we're responsible for our activity. So I'm saying that it's the persistent nature of that. So, and it's also true with the very largest of courts. Occasionally, and I'm going to caution you, software systems are great. But software sometimes comes from a number of vendors. Sometimes those vendors are from other states. Sometimes those vendors are more keyed on accounting principles and processes. They're not as concerned about judicial processes. And so if you're not careful, you can get sucked into letting the computer program or the software program dictate your policies for your court. That's dangerous if those policies are not consistent with our judicial requirements. Guides. Well, of course, the first one would be the Code of Criminal Procedure, Chapter 45. It has been within my time as a municipal judge that we have come out with Chapter 45. For the longest time, municipal courts had no dedicated chapter that were municipal courts and justice courts. Chapter 45 was enacted to give us our own particular chapter. It's important that you read two things. And again, I told you my dad was a minister, so take this with a little bit of grain of salt. But at the same time, I believe that there are always documents that you can read, and every time you read them, you'll get a different. You'll see something you never saw before. I think that's true with the Bible. You read the Bible, and every once in a while, you'll go, "Wow, I never saw that one before." It's true with Constitution, but it's also true with the Code of Criminal Procedure, Chapter 45. If you have never sat down and read the entire Chapter 45, and yes, I know it sounds like a geekish thing to do, but I suggest that you do it. It's not that long. The other thing is read through all the judicial canons. Judicial canons, the second one. Read through the judicial canons. Every time you read them, you'll find something that sticks with you because you're going, "Wow, since the last time I read that, I've had a particular situation that's arisen, and I see how that one's relevant." And then disciplinary opinions and records. Again, those are kind of like what I used to do with the State Bar Journal. And yeah, there's a part of them that makes you nervous to read them. And you kind of go, "If I touch these pages, I'm going to be infected." So you're kind of nervous about doing it, but it's worthwhile because it kind of jolts you back. And sometimes, and hopefully, after you read those disciplinary decisions, your question should be, there has to be more information. Because normally, this sounds really bad, but I was going to say, almost every one of those things, I'm thinking, "Wow, I've done something that someone could probably construe that way." That's the paranoid in me coming out. Code of Criminal Procedure, Article 4501, to provide fair notice to a person appearing in a criminal proceeding before a justice or municipal court, and to provide meaningful opportunity for that person to be heard. Meaningful opportunity for that person to be heard. It is not enough that we have a system. It is far more important that we have a system where that person feels like they could be heard, and that you actually... How many of you, and I bet you a lot of you are going to raise your hands on this one, but this is a compliment to you, and it is, how many people in here have had, you found someone guilty after a trial, and they've still come up to you and said, "You know, I still differ with you. I still think I'm not guilty, but at least you listened to me," right? That should feel good to you. That's a sign that you're providing meaningful opportunity to be heard. Too often, I think people just think, "I'm going to go up there and it's just a kangaroo court. You don't care. You're not really listening." By the way, we actually did once have a case involving a wallaby. Do you know what a wallaby is? We had a prohibited animal case, and a wallaby is a small kangaroo. And I wanted him to bring it up to the court so I could have my picture taken with it, just to say, "See, this is a true kangaroo court." Anyway, but they come up there thinking that you're not really going to listen to them. This is just a sham. It's there for the cha-ching. But when they say, "Okay, you listened. Yeah, I still didn't. You still found me guilty, but you listened." That's a true compliment. Code of Criminal Procedure also says, number two, to ensure appropriate dignity in court procedure without undue formalism. That is the importance of Chapter 45. Some of the procedures that you'll find in the rest of the Code of Criminal Procedure are highly complex and require procedural detail. Chapter 45 gives you a little bit of license to do what's fair and right, as long as it's within within the general guise of justice. So again, Chapter 45 is our out. Also three, to promote adherence to rules with sufficient flexibility to serve the ends of justice and to process cases without unnecessary expense or delay. If there's an area that everybody's going to get on your case, it's going to be that last part. If you fail to process cases quickly or within reasonable time and without undue expense or delay, your city council is going to be upset, and even the public will. And I think that's even with Dallas, I think that's what they're looking at, numbers. Scenario one, let's talk about a more practical situation. That is, let's say, particularly with Canon 1 in mind, you have someone appears in your court on a Class C misdemeanor offense at trial, and you have a prosecutor there. The prosecutor is constantly making valid legal objections to the defendant. So the defendant feels that they cannot get their story out. What are the issues here? What's wrong? What can you do about it? Is there anything wrong? If the defendant's there, and you can tell, and I particularly feel for them when they're presenting before a jury, and they're trying to make those points and the prosecutor's objection, Your Honor, no predicate lay, blah, blah, blah. All the procedural details are all valid objections. How can you as a judge address that? And what's important if you don't? Yeah. Right to be heard. The defendant goes, this is my day. You know, and actually, I think we've been hurt by one other thing that has nothing to do with district courts or anything to do with the system. It's called television. Judge Judy. Have many of you watched those shows? Watch them in sheer horror. Because there, the judge becomes not only the judge, they become the advocate for one side or the other. I was watching one, Judge Joe Brown, and he's doing all the questioning. And in fact, at one point, he goes, no, wait, you. Now, didn't you really, blah, you know, I'm going, wow, at what point did, they're no longer judges. But the problem with that is that many of the people that come to our court who can't afford an attorney, they come to our court, that's their perception of how the system's supposed to run. And they think that if you're not doing that, you're not doing your job. So it's a little bit different for us because now we're coming in there, they're thinking that they can tell their story and they're going to get up there and objections are being made and you're trying to help them not make their story. What can you do? Can you do anything to help them? I really don't have a really good answer to it, but I suppose pretrial conferences might be of some help. I'll also suggest that at some point, as long as it's still within the rules, that you don't sustain every objection made. Again, you need to apply the rules, and the rules are ultimately the answer, but you have to allow the defendant to make to present enough information that their story can be made. And I don't think you give them legal advice for it. I guess that's it. Significant canons. For all those of you who have not seen the canons, yeah, yes. I think with that second part of what you said, I think that's a really good answer, is that you say, counsel, what specifically are you trying to, you know, to ask them to help explain it. Can we give advice? The answer is no. The legal answer to that is flatly no. We cannot give legal advice. But do we not serve a function of explaining what's going on in the process? I think if you're talking about process-related answers, the answer is yes. So if you're explaining what's happening or occurring, it's just that you can't make you can't direct the defendant on what they should do next. For instance, I think one of the most difficult admission of evidence, laying predicate for a document or a picture, I've lately have had a tremendous number of, and of course I have a lot of college students, and everything they have in their life is on their telephone, right? And so they'll come into the court and say, no, I have pictures, see? And they'll hold up their, yeah, are you admitting that into evidence? Why, yes I am. I'm going, I don't think you mean to, you know, because they want, so, yeah, at some point I go, well, you have to understand that if you admit that into evidence, it's at least in possession of the court, at least until all periods of appeal have run. And unless you don't plan on getting phone calls for the next 2 months, I'm thinking you might want to find some other way to present that information. I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I feel like there are many times that I have ultimately, I hope I'm not giving legal advice, but at the same time, I'm sure that in my move to try to explain, I have headed them in that direction. I feel your pain. Yeah.
One of the biggest problems I have in trials in that area is about the minors. When you have children younger and younger and younger who are entitled to a trial, you give them an opportunity to hire a lawyer, but mom or dad won't hire a lawyer. You can't let mom or dad be an attorney in the case.
Well, Or maybe even more fundamentally, sometimes I hear a lot of failure to attend school cases. And those are, of course, I call those the dockets from hell because they are painful. They're long. They're tedious. Judge Mosley came up and watched, and I think she saw how painful it was for us. One of the things I see there, particularly in my city, is that you'll have defendants, you'll say, do you want to plead not guilty, guilty or no contest? The kid goes, oh, yeah, I haven't been to school in like 3 months, you know. And the mom goes, no, he's been. And you're going, well, I said, no, do you want to enter a plea of guilty or not? And so you have to break that down and force that so that you're getting the child's or the minor's opinion or their answer. Well, and I think the other thing is that there's a follow-on to that. The parents, they're required to be there, right? But why do we have parents attend juvenile or minor proceedings? Yeah, I do too. What's kind of a sad comment is I've usually noticed that the kid caught on a lot faster than the parent caught on. You know, the when I say kid, the juvenile defendant's sitting there going, okay, I understand. And really, I don't have any questions because I haven't shown up in school in a long time. And so they kind of drop it. It's the parent that's frustrated. They're going, and you can see them gyrating. I allow them to even sit with them at council table because they can be present. But I do that. You have to whisper the... You know, and so it makes it very tedious. At some point, usually the juvenile just quits asking the stuff, you know, or they call mom and dad to the stand. Of course, I love that, you know, say, this is your one chance to ask mom and dad whatever you want while they're under oath. I don't have any good answers. I just have problems. Canon 1, independent and honorable judiciary is indispensable to justice. You know, that comment that I made about Dallas, again, I'm not trying to get into the issues with Dallas, but again, we are one of three branches of the government, and it is very important that your own city council understands that I am blessed to have council, that kind of institutional knowledge has been passed on through the time. We have good city attorneys who have passed that information on, but if your city attorney is not helping you out and you have council members who don't know, your life as a municipal judge could be really, really bad. So independence is absolutely essential. The public has to perceive that we are truly independent. And integrity and independence of judiciary is preserved. Canon 3B, not to be swayed by partisan interest, public clamor, or fear of criticism. Again, when that one time I set that $5,000 murder bond, that was a painful month for me. And it was really kind of one of those weird deals. I went down to the jail one day and I didn't have any advance notice. The guy was down there. And one of the detectives had that note up, says, please call when judge comes in. And so he came down then. And I probably shouldn't have listened to this. And I really, he goes, you know, judge, I know I'm not supposed to ask you to set how much to set a bomb, but this individual, he turned himself in on this murder charge this morning. And he, you know, and so forth. And so can you set a bond? And I said, well, you know, I don't, you know, like. And I said, I'll set one. It's probably like $10,000. He goes, oh, that high, huh? And I was going, oh, okay. And there's that part of me going, no, stupid, don't go down the path. But did I listen? No. And so I ended up setting a $5,000 murder bond, right? So I go back to my office. The phone rings. My secretary was out. I picked up the phone, and he goes, hi, this is Steve Stoller with Fox 4 News. Is the judge in? Hi, if you hold just a second, I'll check. You think I'm kidding, don't you? So I put him on hold and went, oh, God, it's, you know, now up in our area, Fox 4 News is one of those that's aggressive. Now, they have two news shows. They have the 9 to 10 o'clock, and they have 10 to 10:30. And during the 9 o'clock, those are 8-minute-long segments. I know because I timed it. I finally pushed the button. I said, hi, this is Rob Ramsey. Going to help you because I didn't want to think that I was, you know, fooling with him. And he goes, hi, you know, judge, I was just wondering, is there any reason why you would set a $5,000 murder bond? Well, now, first of all, do I have any ethical issues there? Can I tell him the facts of why I set a $5,000 bond? Nope, can't. Why? For that one brief moment in time, I'm talking about an unindicted case, why can I not answer that question for the press? Because I have my reasons. Why? Because for that period of time, it is a case pending before my authority as a judge or magistrate. Until his indicted case, I am the only magistrate that has considered or heard any part of that. I am the judge, for a common parlance. I am the one that's made that decision, and so therefore, it is me that would have to make. I am the one that would have to make any decisions on that. So I cannot. You can never comment on a currently pending case before your court, right? or one that might come before your court, not on the facts. So, and I knew that part, and I said, well, let me get back to you on that. So I called down to the Judicial Conduct Commission, actually has someone who deals with media relations. Very nice lady, at least she was, and I called her, and of course the first thing she said was, stop screaming. The second thing she said is, you know the answer to this, you really do, and that is that you cannot answer the question. The only thing I'll direct you to do is go back to the law. You tell her, you tell them that I can't comment on the current case, but I can direct you toward the appropriate area in which there are set bonds, and that's actually under chapter or Article 1517 regarding, 1715 regarding the appropriate levels. You know, you consider dangerous society, risk of flight, propensity to reappear, all those things. So I actually cut and paste that. I called back Steve Stoller, said I can't comment on it directly, but I'm going to send you this email. Actually, Steve Stoller was very nice about it on the 9 o'clock news thing. Sat there for 8 minutes. He was really very gentle with me, but of course the problem is it made me look like a complete stupid idiot. And Chris, as soon as the story is over, the phone rings. It was my mom. And without any other words, she goes, $5,000 on a murder? And I said, Mom, you're supposed to be like on my side. But I'm telling you, that decision with the press, with my counsel, because it was a hot issue with the press, that counsel, you know, they were being nice, but they were going, so how's that bond thing working for you? Yeah, and so they were nice, but I knew the underlying score is, I could suffer from that. So stories that appear on the media, print or otherwise, can be very painful. Scenario two. Second scenario is that defendant comes into court wanting special treatment, asking for dismissal or deferred because he knows the chief, mayor, city council. Do you treat them any differently? No. Also, don't insult them, but yeah, don't treat them any differently. Or the other flip side of that would be a defendant says, well, I'm going to go to the media. And again, I hear this one all the time, and I'm sure you do too. I'm going to talk to the press. I'm going to get, you know, in almost every one of our cities, we have one of the local stations that does, you know, those advocate things. And you say, fine, you know, just make sure whatever you say, they would be okay with it. And then when it reprints real nicely, and that you didn't use any comments that you'd be sorry about later on. But the important part is that they're treated the same, exactly the same as everyone else, that their documentation is provided in the same format, because you know that if they're going to the media, they're going to take all that with them. A judge shall require order and decorum in proceedings before the judge. Canon 3B. A judge shall require order and decorum in proceedings before the judge. Showstoppers. Now, I don't know if this works, because the last time we tried it, it didn't. Well, there's your answer. So I guess whatever it was a showstopper. Scenario three. Example given, so I'll have to give you a kind of short version. And this I think we're seeing in larger and larger numbers. How many of you have now those court systems where you're using handheld ticket writers? My city went to it. For those of you who have had it, have you noticed any difference in the number of cases being filed? Yeah, I'm thinking that the police officers, once they have them on their screen and they have any number of check boxes available to them, it's really easy to go, that one, that one, that one, that one. I mean, I have seen someone light a guy up with 9 violations on one stop. Now, I'm not supposed to be the defendant's advocate, but I'm going, guys, wow. You know, the public can't absorb this, and they're seeing that as being mean and cruel. So I'm saying with technology comes ease, and with ease comes laziness, and with laziness comes large numbers sometimes, because numbers are easy to produce than quality justice. but you have somebody come in with expired motor vehicle registration, charge of driving or license invalid, no driver's license, and I do see that one often, no driver's license and driving or license invalid, I feel like pick one. And failure to maintain proof of responsibility, second offense or more. And they go, look, I have money, man, and I'll pay anything to get these all deferred. You just name the price. We've got a deal. Problem? Well, Yeah. Now, let's be honest. You know that most people that pay and sometimes deferred, unfortunately, you have to be careful with deferred. Deferred sometimes is handed out to those people who have the money to pay the differences. Because time pays, very often we say in many courts, you're not eligible. You have to pay your deferral fees up front. Been a change in Chapter 45 that allows you to pay it out over time. But I think some of our courts have been cautious to do that. Be careful that your policies and procedures, particularly for special ways in which cases are dismissed, are handled the same for those who have money and for those who don't. Flip side of that scenario, what about the guy that comes in and says, you know, man, this surcharge thing, I just never can get ahead of it, man. I'm trying to save up the money. Is there any way you can cut down the fines or maybe get these dismissed so I don't get an... Because you know that DWLI, and I will say this as a general statement, this surcharge system has created a category of driver that will never, ever crawl out of this hole. We have doomed some people to never having any hope, and they've given up. And so they're just going, hey, it's just a matter of catch and release, baby. Just get me in there, and I'm going to get caught, and I'm okay with it. So we're creating that category. But those people who are honestly trying to come back, they get hit with another DWLI. Guess what happens? They get another surcharge, and they're losing hope quickly. Do you treat them any differently? I think the answer is theoretically no. There should be that part of you that administers justice. And I tell this to my clerks all the time, because clerks love process. They love process. And when you break their process, they get really angry with you, right? And you go, wait, no, it was my process anyway. But they're the ones that get upset when you break your own rules. But the truth of it is, and I tell them all the time, look, at the point that we don't make exceptions to our rules within the law, then we no longer have jobs, because they can replace us all with computers. Because if you always fill in the formula, there's no point to our existence. Canon 3b, a judge shall be patient, defined, and courteous. Sometimes that's hard to do with certain defendants. But we are required to be patient, dignified, and courteous. A judge shall perform judicial duties without bias or prejudice. Canon 3b continued, or 6. A judge shall not manifest bias or prejudice based upon race, sex, religion, national origin, disability, age, sexual orientation, or socioeconomic status. Believe it or not, some of this has changed in the last 20 years as far as some of the wording. Of course, now we include sexual orientation or socioeconomic status. And I'm also going to say this, for those of us, and I'm, you know, older, and I think that we are all born with certain biases and beliefs, and that many of us, although I'm beginning to see a little bit of turnaround, people with had kids with really long hair now, long hair's coming back, and I've had kids go, you wouldn't understand, you're just doing this because I'm long hair. I'm going, now look, there was a time when my hair was twice as long as yours, and I was, you know, 200 pounds lighter, so things change, over my friend. But there are presumptions. We have to be very careful about what we say, because even when we don't think that we're being biased, we don't think that we're showing some kind of predetermined opinion, we are, or we could be. So it's a very careful line we walk. Scenario 4, according to the book, Scenario 4 is Killing Them with Kindness, Canon 3. Again, it's easy to be frustrated with motions and requests. And you have those people that file request for discovery upon request for discovery. And I'm not actually sure that I know the exact status. I do believe there were some legislative bills passed requiring the state to provide a defendant with discovery documents. Now, most of us provide some form of discovery within our court, and sometimes it's difficult to make a distinction between that and a PIA request, Public Information Act request made to the appropriate authorities. But people will pepper us with requests for information. Again, that's where I think the internet has proliferated a lot of that. People go online and they find these forms that you're supposed to file and, you know, supposed to get, I want to personally examine the radar unit that they had in the car. I'm going, look, it's in the car. What part of that you don't understand? Well, I'd like to take possession of it so that I can examine it. No, they're not going to let you borrow the squad. Hey, I'm just going with that thought. The chief's a little bit picky about that. So people, you know, they pepper you with those requests and those written. Again, you know what we have on our side? We have the power. This is going to sound a little evil. But we have the power and the grind of the system. The system is bigger than us all. And I can say that. I'm a big guy. No, the system is bigger than us all. It will eventually grind down even the most sincere of defendants if over time. As an attorney, I learned over time that you can play the discovery game, run up lots of costs for your client, run up lots of costs for the other side, and you generally got nothing for it. So even I have had to learn that the hard way. Standards apply to all. Canons require the judge hold attorneys and staff to the same standard. Particularly careful for those smaller courts. I have two courts that are very different, very small. Crum, which actually for 2 weeks in December is actually known as North Pole. Anyone know that one? They legally have changed. I don't know how a city legally changes its name, but they have an ordinance that does it. And they receive mail from the North Pole. Anyway, very small court. Meet twice a month. Have a very nice clerk there. I have a clerk in Pilot Point who's very good at what she does, but she has developed policies and procedures that I haven't even heard of. And I'll go to court and they go, well, the clerk told me that I couldn't do blah, 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 blah. I'm going, huh? And I'm looking over and she goes, that's my policy. And I'm going, whoa, 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 whoa. Clerk, you know, what the clerk does, be careful. And in fact, to that extent, find out what your clerk is saying. Because particularly if you're in a small court, they can be running the show and you'll have no clue. What they tell a defendant that walks up on a Tuesday afternoon when you're not there, gosh only knows where he goes from there. Canon 6 prohibits a judge from initiating, permitting, or considering ex parte communications. Again, we had some discussion about that. With the exception of uncontested matters, mitigating circumstances following a plea of no contest or guilty for a fine-only offense. So we, again, have a specific reference in the judicial canons or otherwise is allowed by law. Mediation and so forth. And there are some huge exceptions for fine-only offenses or for Class C, for municipal court judges and justice of peace that are specifically set forth in judicial canons. Some of those are, for those of you who are attorneys, there are some nice ones in there, like we can perform mediations as an attorney. We can perform mediations for a fee when a district or county court judge can't. I don't know why they made the exception. I think they have the assumption that there is no such thing as a full-time municipal court judge. Whatever that's supposed to mean. Guides. Canons. Again, if you've not read them, seriously, maybe not today, but read them. We've given you most of them. Canons 4 and 5 are not in there. 4 and 5 are really more applicable to some other, to some financial requirements, so they're not included. But I think they're worth reading as well. So read all the canons at some point. Every year, I think every one of us should sit down and read Chapter 45, and the canons, read the opinions. I hope they scare you. They scare me. And I hope that at the end of it, you're going, I wonder if I know the whole story. And then, of course, the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure. But remember, you ultimately are the guides. You're the ones that make the decision. So I think that about covers it. I realized that today we didn't really talk about a whole lot of substantive law. At the same time, I think one of the values of these seminars that we have is that we get to share ideas and that it's a refresher course because every one of us, every year, could stand a little bit of refreshing. So, any questions? Well, good. Does anyone have any questions, seriously? All right. Then I guess you're free to go.
All right. Well, next session starts at 10:45.